Well, as Ed said, I've been asked to share the story of this past year, 18 months of our lives. And it's a story of Marge dealing with her cancer and then dying. You know, this is not a morbid subject, actually. It was an adventure for us. Everyone in this room is going to face this one way or another. I'm here to tell you what you can expect through the grace of God, because that's what we've received. On August 31st, 2011, Marge didn't have any symptoms, just one little, you know, catch in her esophagus, and went into the hospital, did a CAT scan. It came back with the report that it was an inoperable cancer, stage 4, and it had spread through her body. Well, talk about a game changer. You know, you stop and you look and you think. So that night, Marge and I were talking about it, and we said, well, let's go for this one more time. I remember I was 21 and just gotten married and was really getting into the scriptures on my own. That was before I met Ed Rice. And I came across this verse, and I was kind of a recovering agnostic or existentialist, let's say. You know, if you're an existentialist, nothing means anything. And here God is saying, now I can do immeasurably more than you can ask or imagine. And so he says, try me. Ask. And so I ask. When I get all done asking, he shakes his head and says, I can do immeasurably more than that. Try again. And so I ask again. And he says, I can do a lot more than that. You're just not good with words. Just let your imagination run. And so I let my imagination run. And when he gets all done, he says, I can do immeasurably more than that. Well, I talked to Marge about that. And the bottom line was, we decided that we would never turn something down because we felt personally inadequate. Because if we only did those things we felt adequate for, where would the God factor be? And we lived with that for the rest of our lives. I would have to say that God has fulfilled that over and over in our lives. And so we thought, well, okay, let's do this one more time. Here, we don't know what kind of time we have. They gave her 3 months as a prognosis, but that was if she didn't take chemotherapy. And so we agreed to that. And what Marge and I would do, she'd kind of run out of gas about 7:30 at night, head for the bedroom, and I'd go with her. She'd get ready for bed, and I'd climb into bed with her, and we'd spend the next couple of hours. We would talk, and I would share the stuff that I was getting, and she was, of course, using the scriptures as well, and she would share with me what she was seeing, and we would pray. My prayer life has really plummeted since she's gone. But we would pray together. And the last phrase that I've included in here was something that I had never caught before. It says, to him be glory. Well, at the end of the day, that's what life is all about. To him be glory. Now, what does that mean? How do you glorify God? Well, the best illustration I can think of is in the book of John, where Jesus talks about his relationship with his Father. And of course, you're familiar with this, where he talks, I can't of my own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is right because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And he talks always about how what he says, what he does, doesn't come from him, it comes from his Father. So in John 14, he says, you guys have seen the Father. And they, you know, when was that? You know, Philip speaks up and, you know, run him past one more time so we can see him. And he says, well, have I been so long with you? You see me, you see the Father. So Jesus reflected the light of the Father. It's the sun and the moon. The sun has the light, the moon doesn't. We live by the light of the moon at night. Well, it's not its light. It's the moon glorifies the sun. And so Jesus glorified the Father. We glorify Christ in the same way. The good thing is you don't have to feel good, be at the top of your game. You don't have to, you know, get out and do anything to glorify God. you just reflect him wherever you are and whatever's going on. And it was amazing as we would pray that, we would see that kind of thing happening. It really kind of set us back. This was really a game changer for me, of course. I went through my calendar and canceled everything. I mean, just took everything off my calendar, even my weekly meetings with people around town and Bible study groups, and they just canceled it. And I thought, you know, this is the time for me to get even with Marge. She's been serving me all her life, and I'm going to serve her. It it cleared my calendar, but then also I cleared my mind. I began to ask the question, what does the Bible say about this? What can I learn? And so this, what I'm telling you now is this is kind of the biblical pilgrimage we took over those months. The question, why is she sick, never entered my mind, or our minds. And the reason is we already had the answer to that. And here's a passage of scripture that not very many people seem to have a hold of. And I don't know if you're familiar with that. I'm sure you're familiar with it. You've read it over. But like me, you know, I'll read something and all of a sudden it'll come back and it makes sense for the first time after all these years. Paul says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation. Now, what's the creation? Well, it's the universe and everything that's in it. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. So the creation is waiting for something. There's just a natural world. For the creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Well, I said that this verse gives us the answer to why Marge had cancer. What's the answer? Well, the key word is frustration. Somehow, the natural world has been subjected to frustration. You look up that word, and there it is. Other translations, it can be futility, vanity, depravity, frailty. In other words, the natural world doesn't work the way it should. Now, who did it? Who subjected it to frustration? Huh? Devil. God. Now think of that. God's subjected the created world to frustration. And there's a reason. Why? Why did he subject it to frustration? Well, it's with a hope that the creation itself will be liberated. And that liberation is contingent on the liberation of his people. What God is up to in the world is he's creating a family, a people. And who would seek him if we were here in paradise? No needs. So basically what happened was God kicked us out of the garden. And so we live with pain because if we didn't have pain, if we didn't have to live with the reality of the consequences of sin, there would be no seeking after God. And, of course, you know that the flow of Scripture from Genesis to Revelation is God trying to fulfill the answer to the question in Genesis 3, where are you? And so it's God's pursuit. Well, so why does Marge have cancer? Well, it's because she's a part of the human race. He subjected the human race to the disease. And so sometimes the way we treat the sovereignty of God, it's almost like fatalism. It's almost Eastern religion stuff where it's karma. It's just God has designed it. But that's not true. There's a randomness about life. There's a randomness about creation. And God isn't saying, okay, I'm going to give her cancer, but no, I'm not going to. And then he picks them out. No, that's not the way. I think the natural world just is what we see here. There's a futility to it, a frailty to it, and we're a part of it. So we live with that. But he says, that will work for me, is what God says. Well, then, the question that came next for me was, where's Marge going? You know, what's coming for her? And first thing you say at a funeral, what is it? She's in a better place. And, of course, that's true. You know, that question doesn't really satisfy at a time like this. My question was, well, what kind of a place? Where is she? You know, you say, well, she's in heaven. Okay, so the classical painters, you know, here's heaven, there's a cloud, and here are these people sitting on it, and they're making music. And I think forever and ever, you know, that's pretty boring. Or you look at, like, Revelation 4, and here are all these people, and they're singing, and they're praising. And I remember when I looked at it as a kid, I thought, you know, heaven is an eternal church service. And I thought, what are the options? You know, it just seemed like, you know, I'd been to the previews and I didn't like it. But there's, you know, we struggle with this. What's it going to be like? Will we, like Eric Clapton, you know, when his son got killed, he wrote the song, "Will You Know My Name If I See You in Heaven?" The question is, well, what is it going to be like? I really wondered about that. Of course, the go-to place on that is what we've got up here, the resurrection of Jesus. It says, Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. And the first fruits, of course, you know, it's the first of more of its kind. And so Jesus was the first of more of that kind. And so we're going to be like him. And then it goes on and explains, this is in 1 Corinthians 15, as was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. As is the heavenly man, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so shall we bear the image of the heavenly man. And so the question is, what was Jesus like when he rose from the dead? That it will tell us what we will be like in the resurrection. About this time I got a copy of N.T. Wright's book, Surprised by Hope. And in it, he asks the question, which I found intriguing, how empty was the tomb? When Jesus rose, how empty was the tomb? Well, the cloths were still there. Jesus or somebody somehow, you know, folded up the wrapping that was around his head and had it laying there. But every part of his body was gone. You know, that's intriguing because Jesus took on a body. Not the same, different kind of matter, but he took on a body. And he was recognizable. You know the stories of how he'd visit them. He would eat. He cooked fish on the beach. And the guys afterwards could say, well, that was maybe just an illusion. Well, there are the fish bones. They're still there, and the fire is still warm. And so you couldn't escape the fact that he was there. The conclusion is that, you know, at least this observation, that after death, you know, there's identity. There's personhood. There's a reality as we would understand it. About this time, Bob Bedano came over. He shared this verse with me. I thought, boy, that really fits what we're dealing with. 2 Corinthians 5, 4 and 5. Well, for while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened. And I look at Marge and I say, yeah, she groans and she's burdened. Because we do not wish to be unclothed. You know, so you're ambivalent. You know, do I want to die? But to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling. And so that's what we long for. So that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. And Bob pointed out that that's a redefinition of the word death. Is the mortal being swallowed up by life? Like Jesus says, you believe in me, you'll never die. And that's what this says. Mortality, the mortal, is swallowed up by life. And then this next phrase, now the one who has fashioned us for this very purpose is God. The interesting thought here is that here now, you know, we all think about the purpose for our lives and we're, you know, purposeful in everything we do. me at this point in my life, more than ever, I'm purposeful. But what this says is I haven't really entered into the real purpose for my being yet. And so, you know, that's just something that you know, stops me in my tracks and makes me think about this. But then my question still was, well, okay, but where is she going? What's it going to be like? I'm not going to satisfy you with my answer, but I'm going to lead you into some things that you'll be thinking about. Revelation 21, John writes, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a beautiful bride, dressed for her husband. And then it says, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. Well, the impression here is that heaven is not a location off someplace. Heaven, we'll experience it here in this environment. A recreation. I don't think that, in fact, I think that there's going to be a different set of laws of physics. How can you have a recreation and still have, you know, the second law of thermodynamics, you know, the law of entropy, that everything degenerates? Well, I think that's going to be rescinded. There's going to be a new kind of matter. There's going to be a new kind of time. The matter of space is going to be different. So you grapple with these things and you realize, well, my mind isn't quite big enough to get around them. But here are a couple other verses that add to the conjecture. And that's what it is, conjecture. He who descended is the very one who ascended higher than all the heavens in order to fill the whole universe. And he's not just thinking about this globe, this earth. He's thinking about the whole universe. The reconciliation, the time of God bringing in his kingdom, everything is going to be transformed. And then 2 Peter 3, in keeping with this promise, we're looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. I'd have to say that that's what blows my mind more than anything. Do you realize how much time we spend dealing with evil? You know, first in our own hearts and struggling just with the evil that comes along in the course of a day. But then in our society, our culture, in the world, we could resolve the problem of poverty in a heartbeat if we could resolve the problem of human evil. Because the basic problem is corruption, seeking for power, these things. Well, with that gone, I mean, it's just beyond my comprehension to think of what that would be like. Then there's this that gives us a little bit more light on the subject. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light. But then the nations will walk in its light. Will there be nations there? Well, yeah. And the kings of the earth, will there be kings? Well, yeah, they'll bring their splendor to it. What's that? The glory and the honor of the nations will be brought into it. It sounds like we're going to have work to do. It sounds like we're going to be busy. It sounds like he has plans for the universe, and we are an integral part of it. And, you know, knowing God, he's an inveterate creator. He's always at it, always creating something. And the question is, what's he up to now? Well, we can't really tell. Just there's so much. Well, then the question comes, why? Why is God doing all this? And, you know, I just thought, boy, all of this that he's done, he's doing, what he's put up with, what it cost his son, why is he doing all this? Well, we have the answer in this verse from John 17. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I and them, you and me. So Jesus is looking for something that involves us. And he says, I have loved them even as you have loved me. So the driving force in all of this is what? Yeah. Which is just, you know, it's just mind-boggling. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am, to see my glory. the glory you have given me because you loved me before the creation of the world. Righteous Father, though the world does not know you, I know you, and they know that you have sent me. I have made you known to them, will continue to make you known, in order that the love you have for me may be in them, that I myself may be in them. That's Jesus' aspiration for us, and it will be fulfilled. Well, that's just staggering. The last days that Marge had, I think 3 days before she died, I came across this verse in Isaiah, just in my reading. As a young man marries a young woman, so will your builder marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will God rejoice over you. Wow. So here's Marge, and I'm getting ready to let her go. And God is getting ready to receive her. Which goes along with this verse that we're familiar with. Precious is in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. So, okay. God says, it's like my bride is coming. And he's excited about that. And then my thought ran to this passage, which fits right in. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. And so here's the bride, and she's coming into God's presence, and he's excited like a bridegroom waiting for his bride. Well, this verse had a history with Marge and me. Remember back in 1964, we were 65, we were in Brazil, had moved to a town where we didn't know a single soul in town, literally not one person. We'd get up in the morning, I'd go about putting things together, trying to, get a foothold in the place. Very absorbed with that, terribly absorbed with that. Then one day I noticed that Marge was in depression. Well, she never got depressed. And here she was depressed. And I stopped and looked and I thought, And I remember when it hit me, this verse came to my mind. And he said, and what God was saying to me is, hey, she's your responsibility. And someday you're going to present her to me, and I don't want to see any spots or blemishes or wrinkles. Well, she showed up with some wrinkles, but nothing little mascara or little, makeup wouldn't help. But at that time, I thought, I have got to assume responsibility for her. Well, I'd forgotten that, here in the U.S., she had her Bible study group. We had our church. She could, turn Theodore Epp onto the radio and listen to him. Some of you even know who that is. And I had forgotten that she had a context in which she operated. And literally, I realized that I had farmed her out, to the Christian community to take care of my wife. Well, that was a mistake. But I realized that there in that situation where we had no church to go to, we had no Christian friends, nothing, that she was my responsibility. Well, I assumed that responsibility. And the story of the next years, the story of the, 1964? So that was, almost 50 years, is that we have walked this together. So now, the question was, okay, she's going into his presence. How'd I do, Lord? Any spots or wrinkles or stains? And it was that changed my perspective on what was going on. Was that, I wasn't losing her. She wasn't losing everything. She was gaining everything. And the anticipation of the fulfillment of this kind of a relationship with God, it just is overpowering. Well, she's been gone 6 months. And I grieve. And I tell you, this sounds weird, but I enjoy grieving. Because it gives me a chance to go back and remember and have all kinds of good memories. So what I do is, I'm still doing this. I have some days I get interrupted, but I'm going through her stuff. I put some of this in my Christmas letter some of you received, where I talked about when somebody dies and they leave everything, well, you go through it. And there are no secrets. I mean, it's just, I mean, you find things. I found a lot of things about her that I never knew. Really interesting. I lived with her for, you know, 58 years, and there are things I didn't know about her. Not that she was hiding them, she just didn't think to tell me. Like, she was a beauty queen in high school. She never told me. You know, you'd think that she'd, you know, tell me that. We went through her dresses, her purses, her shoes. You know, I enjoyed that. And made three piles, you know, toss, take to Goodwill. They know me by name now there. And sort, you know, give to the girls, our daughters. And so, working through things. Well, what I'm finding is that as I see the way she lived, I see that here was a godly woman who had nothing to hide. But anything that I see about her just kind of reinforces the love that I've always had for her. And it's a joy to experience this. Now, what it makes me want to do is, of course, she leaves a hole. You know, I miss her enormously often. But I don't want to just go fill the hole that's there. What I would really like, and what I'm praying for, is that God Himself would fill the hole. That I don't fill it with activities. I don't have a bucket list. There's nothing I want to do to occupy myself. I'm happy to just say, okay, Lord, we've got some years here. Let's go for it. And so there's joy in the middle of all of this. One more thing before I close. I don't know how we were carried through these months the way we were. It was a year between the diagnosis and her death. But we have been prayed for and by so many people. And I don't know if you've ever been on the receiving end of that kind of prayer, but it is just staggering. It's like you're being carried along you're wrapped and carried in the Lord's hand. And it's like the brunt of the things that are hitting you, hitting us, and we never really felt them. And boy, it's made me really appreciate prayer. And makes me want to redouble my efforts at praying for the people, you know, in my life that have needs like this. One other takeaway that I have. Over these months, we've seen God actively loving on us over and over and over again. And often through you, but then just through circumstances that were just mind-boggling. And I could give you, you know, story after story of how God lovingly put his hand into the middle of a day and did things for us that changed the scene. I'll just tell you one story and then I'm done. In March, Marge had a PET scan and they found that she had a gallstone that was acting up and needed surgery. So she had the PET scan, and we sat there with the doctor, and the doctor says, "Well, you're gonna need the surgery." This was on a Friday morning. He said, "But you'll have to get your lungs checked because she was having trouble with fluid accumulating on her lungs. You have to get her lungs checked before we can do the surgery." So, you know, we went over to the pulmonologist's office there in the same building where we were in Penrose. And walked into the office, and the pulmonologist nurse says, "Oh, yeah, we can give her an appointment. This is March 3rd. It'll be the first week of April." Well, Marge said, "Well, I'll be dead by then." And it didn't faze this gal, you know. So we left, and here we were. She needed a surgery. Her lungs were full. She had about a liter of liquid on her lungs. And we went home to have lunch. Well, we're sitting there having lunch, and there's a knock on the door. And it's a lady, Robin is her name. And she walked in, and she said, "Well, I just came to see how you're doing." And so it turns out that she's a doctor herself. And so we told her what was going on. And she said, "Well, my husband is a pulmonologist. Let me call him." So how many pulmonologists' wives have you had come to your house? And so she got on the phone, talked to her husband, Tim. His name is Tim Rummel. She talked to Tim, and he said, "Sure, you know, I'll take her." Well, then she spent the next 2 hours on the phone getting our insurance turned around so that we wouldn't, you know, pay a fortune, had to change hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, at 4 o'clock that afternoon, just when the clinic shut down and it goes to emergency room care, we end up in Tim Rummel's office. And so he looks at the x-ray and the CAT scan, and he says, "You don't need the surgery, but I'll drain your lungs." Well, just that one incident spared Marge a surgery that she probably wouldn't have recovered from and resolved the problem. So you look at that. And you say, I'm going to love him back. Thanks.